Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. Today I welcome back Mike McNichol, the director of the Clatsop County Public Health, to discuss the recent influenza outbreak, as well as an expanding syringe exchange program and a new breastfeeding survey just conducted between the department and the Oregon Health and Sciences University. These are among the public health issues and services the department addresses for the county's 37,000-plus residents. McNichol has some 22 years' experience in public health and has served as the department's director since 2016 and prior to that as its environmental health supervisor. Before joining the health department, he directed the Yamhill County Health Department. He holds a Master's of Public Health from the Oregon Health and Science University. This program was pre-recorded. Welcome to the studio, Mike.
Well, thank you.
I thought we'd start with the flu outbreak because that is the most immediate pressing concern. Where does that stand now in our area?
So as of last week, we did have to close the Napa Elementary School because of the number of absenteeisms from the flu. There we had the school was nearly over 50% vacant, and some classes were up to 70% absenteeism. So we had a conference call with the school administration, the school nurse, Oregon Health Authority, their EPI division, and we talked about, you know, at what level, at what, when should they close, when they should not close. And finally, the recommendation was I recommended to them that if you can no longer work administratively, that you don't have enough staff who are also suffering from the flu, you know, at some point you may have to take some time off to, just because you can't operate anymore. And that's what they decided to do, to close a couple of days and let the flu kind of work through its process, because it does have a 1 to 4 day incubation period, and to make sure that they could get through the whole school, clean it up real well with disinfectants. And then they started opening up on Thursday last week, and they found that the number of absentee rate was dropped in half. So apparently it was a successful intervention to get the kids back.
Thank goodness. Mm-hmm. Have you seen similar problems in other schools in the county?
No, we actually haven't seen it to that degree. So, you know, the population this was most specific to was the kindergartens and the young kids. And, you know, they're not the most hygienic things in the world. So they do have a tendency to use their hands and not wash them frequently. So, you know, when they blow their nose or they cough, they tend to get those germs everywhere. Sure. So that's probably what was causing it.
I thought I'd read that nationally the flu outbreak seems to be going down somewhat. Is that the case in our county?
It appears that, you know, it's kind of a leveling off, maybe. The number of emergency department visits is down. But we do have, you know, this year seems to be particularly tough for the influenza B strain. There are a couple of reasons for it. One is that the vaccine, if you didn't get the quadrivalent instead of the if you took the trivalent to the quadrivalent vaccine, it didn't have that particular Yamamoto flu virus in it for deactivated virus to get immunized. So that's one reason. And number two is that, you know, there are fewer people who didn't get the shots right away. So now we're seeing the flu kind of hit real hard, and we're hoping that the way the news is and the press, the people are now going to start getting more vaccines, and we'll see the numbers drop.
Well, you mentioned two different kinds of vaccines. What kind would we have gotten around here, going to the doctor or going to Fred Meyer or Safeway to get our shot?
Generally, it was the quadrivalent, but there were sometimes early on that there were some trivalent. So the health department only does the quadrivalent. So if you got it there, you should be good.
So the quadrivalent was the more effective. What percentage? Because I know a lot of people are saying it's not worth getting the vaccine because it's only 10 or 20% effective. Mm-hmm. What percent was that shot?
You know, I really couldn't say because we don't really track it that way.
Okay.
So it's hard for me to tell you exactly the number.
But it still is worth people, if they haven't gotten the vaccine, to go and get it?
Absolutely, especially if you're immune compromised or have any sort of immune system problems, or the very young and the very old. You know, if you're at risk for getting the flu and you get it, you're going to be a lot sicker than if you have a strong immune system. You know, people have died. We've had a number of children die, up to 20 now in the country. this flu is not something you want to mess around with. It never is. So we always recommend, you know, practicing strong hygiene practices. Wash your hands. Don't go to your friend's house if they have the flu. If you have the flu yourself, don't go to work. You know, practice some social isolation. And make sure you wash your hands frequently and cover your coughs and your sneezes and really try to protect others. So that, along with the flu vaccine, is the best prevention.
Have you had any cases of hospitalization here?
We've had some. I couldn't tell you how many because it's not a reportable condition, so we don't get those data back. We'll have to ask the hospital at the end how much they've had.
But to your knowledge, no one has died from the flu locally?
Not in Clatsop County.
Can you say more about why the flu is so severe this year?
So it seems to be that there was a couple different vaccines available, and some people got the trivalent vaccine and others got the quadrivalent vaccine, which means there's just instead of three varieties of just virus in the one that has four. And the one that had the four strains was actually more effective. So there's a little bit of that. And also this seems to be, it's just seems to be more prevalent this year. Not sure why. But the best prevention is, you know, getting your vaccine shot and practicing safe hygiene.
And the elderly and children are still the most vulnerable. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Have you seen the flu outbreaks in the elderly, say in local nursing homes?
Well, not yet. So usually we see at least one or two of the homes usually get a flu, and then they go through a pretty serious a regimen of social isolation and make sure everything's clean and protect those and send those who need to go to the hospital. So, but we haven't seen it yet. So hopefully we won't.
If somebody does not have health insurance, can they still get the flu shot?
Yes, they can come to the health department. We just were issued some flu vaccine, the quadrivalent, that's available. If you'd like to get a shot, you can come down and get it any day of the week from 8 to 5.
Is there a charge for that if they don't have the money to pay?
No, you won't have to pay. If you don't have the ability to pay, we'll make sure you still get it.
Are you giving out a lot of vaccinations to people who cannot pay?
We see quite a number. I don't know exactly how many, but most people do have either OHP or a private insurance.
Okay.
But for those who don't have it, we still are able to get them the vaccines.
Okay.
They need.
I'm just thinking of some of the homeless population in the area. Does anyone go out and offer it to them?
Actually, we were at the Homeless Connect event, and we did offer the vaccine
really?
At that time.
Mm-hmm. And that was down in Seaside. Few weeks ago?
Yep, that was last week.
Okay. And did you give out many vaccinations there?
I think we gave, I don't know the exact number, it was in the teens.
Oh, well, that's good enough. Yeah. How long is the vaccination good for?
It's good for a season, so you'll have to get revaccinated next year.
Okay.
And because the strains change, so we may have the four different strains we see now. Come next year, there may be four different other kinds that weren't
sure.
present last year. So that's why it's only good for a year.
And how is it that scientists are able to predict how to develop the vaccination for the next season?
So what they do is they look at the southern hemisphere. So we have a whole summertime here to enjoy a non-flu season. At the same time, the southern hemisphere is going through a winter season of flu. So they monitor the strains that happen in the southern hemisphere. So then when it comes time for us in fall and winter, we know pretty much what will be coming our way.
So they spread up north through travel?
Travel, just general routes of travel.
Okay. And the virus will mutate, generally speaking, from year to year?
You can see some mutation, but again, they can design the vaccine based on those kind of strains as well. So.
Okay. All right. Because people wonder, why can't they change the vaccine mid-season if it's not that effective?
That's because all of the manufacturers usually gear up based on what the CDC recommends for them to gear up for. Doing it midstream would probably be, we wouldn't even see it until way after the flu season is done, and it takes too long.
Another criticism I've heard of the vaccine is that it has mercury in it. Is that true?
That is incorrect. It does not have the thimerosal in it anymore. It's basically preservative-free, and so those concerns aren't really valid.
And can someone get the flu from the vaccine? Because that's another concern that a number of people have.
Sure. Well, some people can experience very mild symptoms from having a flu vaccine, but you cannot get the flu from the flu vaccine. The virus, the strains are in the flu vaccine itself, are dead. So basically your body, once it's in the, your body produces antibodies to the dead virus. So it can't actually then regenerate and become the flu.
Okay. And is there a difference in quality of vaccines depending on where you get it? No, whether Fred Meyer's or your doctor's?
It's all the same. They're all the same manufacturers spread it throughout the whole country.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Well, let's transition then to talking about the expansion of the syringe exchange program for IV drug users. Tell me what's going on, first of all, with the program for somebody who may not be aware that we even have one.
Right. So beginning in October 2017, we started a harm reduction program, which is kind of our semantical choice of words for syringe exchange. And our first location was right behind Safeway on 32nd Street.
In Astoria.
In Astoria. And to date, in that location alone from that week, we've collected almost 20,000 needles.
And that is in 4 months?
Yeah.
Were you expecting to collect that many?
Not really, no. I wasn't sure what to expect, but it's been pretty amazing the response that we've gotten. So beyond that, we've also have Jordan's Hope for Recovery works with us as a partner, and they've been doing naloxone training, which is the drug that can do, if you're having an opioid overdose, it's an injectable drug that can actually bring you back. And so we've done up to, I think, 18 or 19 naloxone trainings for these folks who actually come and with their partners, the messengers or whoever they are, they're actually getting trained to save people's lives as well. And we also have been doing some referrals for treatment, and we've had three people at least been able to get into treatment. So we think it's been pretty successful.
So you can do the naloxone training right on the spot?
Yes.
And how long does that take?
It's an 8-minute video.
Really? And then do you get the supplies? And
then we give you the supplies.
Is there any charge for that?
No charge.
And a parent or a loved one could come?
That is true.
And exactly. Be trained?
Absolutely.
And explain who is behind Jordan's Hope.
Her name is Carrie Strickland, and she's the CEO and executive director. She lost her child, Jordan, about 2 years ago. And from that experience, from the opioid, she had an opioid addiction. From that experience, she committed herself to developing Jordan's Hope for Recovery to help other families and other people try to get into treatment and protect themselves and get out of the addiction.
All right. So tell me, how are you expanding the program? The syringe exchange program?
Well, right now we've just, we worked with Providence Seaside, and they were very open about allowing us to be on their campus grounds at the hospital. So we have an agreement to work with them, and on Thursdays between 11:30 and 12:30, we're at the actual on the grounds near the emergency department and have a space for people to come up and do a needle exchange there. So now we're in two locations.
That's kind of out of the way. Do you think the users will find it?
I'm pretty sure they will. You know, most everybody knows where the emergency department is and Seaside. It is on the bus line. It is also a pretty open space so people can come and do the exchange. They can even drive up and do it if they wish not to get out of the car in the rain. So that's what we try to design it around.
And how does the actual exchange work when somebody brings in dirty needles?
So if someone brings in some dirty needles, they usually have them containerized. And when we do a count, and we have a little manual that says if you bring in one quart jug this size, there's this many needles in it, so we're not going to hand count them. And then we exchange that one for one. So we give them an actual Sharps disposal container, the proper kind, as well as a one for one needle. So if they bring in 100, we give them 100.
And you mentioned some of these people bringing the dirty needles in are messengers for other drug users. They may not be the actual user themselves.
Yeah, so we've had a number of folks that we've had some repeat customers now who are messengers who may or may not be using. We do have a survey they have to fill out, and generally the messengers are saying they don't have they're not users. So, so they come in and they trade for 2, 3, 4, and up to 7 people.
If you're just joining me, you are listening to a pre-recorded interview with Clatsop County Public Health Director Mike McNichol. He is discussing the department's recently expanded syringe exchange program for IV drug users and a new breastfeeding survey just completed by the department and Oregon Health and Science University. I'm Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio. Is there any concern when you give 100 needles to a person, for example, a messenger, that the needles may not be getting to the right people who are actually using drugs?
It's possible, although I'm not sure what they would use them for. So,
there's no resale value.
They have no resale value. You can still buy needles at any pharmacy. It's not illegal. If someone wanted to go buy them and not work with us, then they could. But most of the folks we see from the surveys we've been doing is most of them are involved in the addiction.
Now, you started in Seaside at Quatop Park. Is that correct?
Yeah, we started there, and then we met with the city administrator and the chief of police, who requested that we find a new location, and so we did.
Okay. Was there much response? Did you see many needles back at the park?
No, we had only been there twice, so we were just now.
You're just getting started.
Just getting started, and so we respected the city's wishes and worked with Providence.
Sure. The program has been going about 4 months now, and it's funded by a grant out of Columbia County. Is that correct?
It's actually funded by the Coastal Family Board that used to be there before the Yakima farm workers took it over. That board had some money when they were no longer the board anymore. And so they actually offered us the money to do the syringe exchange.
So what happens when that money runs out in a couple months? It's a six-month program, if I'm understanding correctly.
Yeah, so I'm working with we're going to bring the data to the Board of County Commissioners in April, let them know success or however they see it. And then we're going to ask to see if we can get funding to make sure it keeps going forward.
The main criticism that I've seen of programs such as this is that they enable drug addiction and drug use, illegal drug use. How do you respond to that?
So public health isn't too much concerned about the illegality of the actual drug use. Our interest is in actually reducing the harm that comes from using dirty needles in terms of HIV, hepatitis C, endocarditis, big abscesses. Those are the kind of things that we worry about is from a health perspective. We also see it as this is an opportunity when someone comes to see us and they gain trust, is an opportunity for us to get them into help. So they're going to use anyway. If they're addicted to IV drugs, they're going to use. If we have a friendly face, we build trust, we might have an opportunity to actually get them into treatment.
How much longer would you like to see the program extended for?
Well, I think as long as there's an opioid epidemic, I think we'll just have to keep going until we actually have enough ability to treat the number of people we're seeing. I think we'll just have to keep going until we can get everyone into treatment, which could be decades.
So, what are the treatment facilities available like around here?
Choices is one of them. There's a couple of clean facility. There's some others. But again, we're trying to help those who don't have any money and may not have insurance. That's a little trickier. So we're trying to figure out a way to get them into a detox state where they've been detoxed and then try to get into treatment. So we still have some things to work out, but we're making some progress.
All right. Thank you. Well, let's transition then to talking about the breastfeeding study. Tell me a little bit more first about the actual study.
Sure. So we worked with Oregon Health and Science University, their research branch. One of the things we wanted to do was look at, breastfeeding as the Surgeon General has noted, is one of the best interventions you could do for young children, right? Because it provides them antibodies. It's the most perfect food for them. So what we wanted to do is see, based on the number of births in the county, are the women who are actually breastfeeding experiencing barriers to actually providing breastfeeding to their children? So we commissioned this survey. We built a survey tool, and we took it to the hospitals and all these various groups. And based on the surveys we got back, we had the OHSU do the analysis and produced a report.
How many people did you survey?
I think we were about 175.
Okay,
somewhere there.
So that's,
I can't remember exactly. There's a few stragglers. So
around the counties.
Mm-hmm. All in Clatsop County.
And what did you learn from the survey?
So we did learn that, there are some barriers that we're familiar with, that it still seems to be if a woman goes right back to work, there isn't a place to do any expressing of breast milk. There's some barriers in the workplace to bringing, having breastfeeding time, that there is some work to do still on getting the word out about how important it is. Mm-hmm. But we did learn there's a lot of positives, too, that most of the women in the survey knew that was the best food for their kids, but some of them were having some medical issues and some other mechanical issues that needed to be addressed. And it looked like we just need to have a more proactive approach in helping these women with a lactation specialist like our nurse Trina Robinson, who did most of this work, to get out there and really help these women be able to breastfeed effectively and do it for as long as they're comfortable.
Well, explain what Trina does more specifically.
Sure. So Trina Robinson works in our WIC department, the Women, Infants, and Children program, and she's a lactation specialist. So a woman who just recently had a baby, she'd be able to help them. If she had any questions about breastfeeding, Trina knows what to answer, all those answers that she's looking for.
So oftentimes, according to the survey, the problem may not be physical for the woman, that she literally can't breastfeed, but problems, say, going back to work, as you mentioned, she doesn't have a place to express her milk.
Mm-hmm.
Are employers required to provide a place where women can do that?
I'm not sure if they are required to, but I know that, you know, the more young women who want to enter the workforce who are also childbearing age, I think that's an issue. I do know a lot of workplaces who are trying to accommodate, and some don't. I guess it just depends on the kind of work.
What would you like to see? What is required to have, say, a space at work where a woman could do that?
Sure. Well, it would require an office space that's private and provides privacy and comfort for the woman to be able to either express milk or actually feed her baby. If you really want to encourage young women to get into the workplace who are childbearing age, that would be a good perk to allow a worker to say, hey, you know, and for young women who they're trying to attract into their office space or their whatever they're doing, I mean, that would definitely be something that could be looked as a benefit and not as a detriment to their business. So I think they would build loyalty with the women who work there. They could show that they have compassion for what they're trying to do, and they actually care for not only the woman as a worker, but as a woman as a person.
I've seen women using a breast pump in restrooms, mm-hmm. but I would imagine that's not the ideal place to be expressing milk.
I guess you got to do what you got to do, but you know it would be better if they had a space that was private and not, you know, a little more sanitary, and hygiene would be nice.
What percent of women are breastfeeding in our area?
That's a great question. I don't think we actually got an answer for that. So, but the numbers that we saw from all the surveys, at least all the numbers that we surveyed, all of them said they tried. So, and then their success rate was based on some of the barriers they experienced.
Do you have an idea or sense of what the percentage is nationally?
I don't, no.
And how long should, ideally, a child be breastfed?
That's a great question. I think that's a personal choice for women. Some women are comfortable for up to a year or until the baby can eat solid food. Some will go much longer than that. So I think it really is up to the woman and her provider decide, you know, what's the best for the kid.
Are there health benefits for going longer to the children or to the mother?
I think there's some evidence that shows that for the children, you know, they're still building those antibodies that they need for a good, healthy immune system. It's the best food for babies. Going longer, I'm not sure if we have that kind of data. I'm sure there's available, but I'm just not aware of it.
Culturally, is there a general time period, or really does it vary depending on the person?
I think it really does vary on the comfort of the women. So I think that some are comfortable for as long as the kid wants to breastfeed, they'll do it. And others say, you get your first tooth, you're out. So
does social stigma against breastfeeding by some people, certainly not all, also discourage some women from breastfeeding?
I think it does. Yeah, I think there's a certain stigma about, you know, there's the modesty piece about you shouldn't be doing that in public. You should be modest and, you know, go to a darkened room somewhere. I think that's an unfortunate thing that happened in El Carcelor. I think that's valuable for the women to be able to do what they need to do for their kid. That kid is part of our society. We want them to be as healthy as possible. So we're actually making it worse for them than it is better.
What is Oregon law around breastfeeding in public?
That's a great question. I don't know.
I believe women are allowed to do it.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, you can do it. There's no law against it. I don't know under what circumstance it would be illegal. I don't suppose there is one.
All right. I was just curious because I know occasionally you'll read about a case where, for example, I remember one in the Portland area, a woman was breastfeeding at a pool on the deck. And she was asked to leave, I believe. So,
yep, not surprised.
What do you hope now to do with the results that you've gained from the survey?
Yeah, so what we plan on doing, and for those who want to read it, we do have it on our Facebook page in full form. What we want to do next is bring that survey conclusions and the data that we've gathered to the Clatsop County Breastfeeding Coalition and look to them, because it's a group of women and doulas and lactation consultants, from that data kind of tell us what they suggest as the recommendations that might be both practical and policy that we could take back to maybe the Board of Commissioners and say, these are some of the things we think should be done, or, you know, maybe then start out a campaign to or an intervention to help all of our employers, whoever needs to be targeted, to get this information out to them about how to improve the breastfeeding in our county.
Breastfeeding has really come full circle, because I know when I was a baby back in the late 50s, early 60s, doctors were advising women to use formula in many cases, and my mom rebelled against that, thank goodness. But why do you think we've gone from that end now to realizing the huge benefits of breastfeeding?
Well, I think the culture has changed. Number one, it's the doctors in the 50s and 60s, as many have experienced, they were almost seen as infallible with their knowledge. They made no mistakes. Whatever they knew was something you should do. A lot more questions now about whether or not what the doctors know and what they don't know, and a good patient will ask a lot of questions and do research on their own. And I think that science has also caught up to the fact that when you have the testing of breast milk, that is clearly a far superior product than anything that could be made by a company for health as well as antibodies. You can't mimic those things in a product on a shelf. So it's just I think science has finally caught up to and said, there's just no better thing for a little baby to have than to have breast milk. It's just fact.
And it's free.
And it's free.
Well, and the other benefit, what about bonding between mother and child? Oh, I would imagine
absolutely
that would be a great opportunity.
It's vital for the kid. The baby needs to have that, the touch. And breastfeeding has been proven to be absolutely essential in having a good bonding between the mom and baby.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Sure.
We are out of time. I want to thank you for coming into the studio again to talk about health issues facing the county. My guest today has been Mike McNichol, Director of Clatsop County Public Health. He has been speaking about services the department provides, including a recently expanded syringe exchange program for IV drug users and a new breastfeeding survey just out about barriers to breastfeeding in the county. The department offers a diverse range of services to the county's 37,000-plus residents, from family planning to immunizations to disaster preparedness. McNichol has served as the department's director since 2016, and prior to that, as its environmental health supervisor. He holds a Master of Public Health from the Oregon Health and Science University. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. Perspectives was engineered today by Brian Bovenizer. The show can be heard every other Friday on the stations of Coast Community Radio. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. If you would like to contact me, send me an email to perspectives@coastradio.org. Thanks for listening.